Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. In both of Rachel Kushner's previous novels, her richly drawn characters inhabit highly detailed worlds, filled with realistic knowledge of its time and place. Revolutionary Cuba and its expatriate American community in Telex from Cuba, her debut novel, and the 1970s New York art scene and underground in her follow-up, The Flamethrowers. Her latest book is no different, The Mars Room. Through her main narrator, Romy Hall offers a grittily realistic and darkly comic view of a California woman's prison. Kushner's character reflects an all-too-typical story in contemporary American life. A woman, born in poverty, growing up in a home broken by substance abuse, finds herself as the target of an unwanted male attention. His death results in her arrest, conviction, and incarceration. Kushner's years of work as an advocate for the incarcerated helps inform the characters and situations she describes in the novels. Conan, a woman so masculine she was actually incarcerated in a men's jail until the mistake was realized. Sammy, a devoted cellmate who's lived most of her life in and out of institutions. And Gordon Hauser, a GED teacher working with prisoners who's become captive to his own life situation. The Mars Room was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize and won the French Prix Medici in 2018, and the book is now out in softcover. Rachel Kushner will be speaking about the book Thursday evening at 7 at B'nai Amuna in a BookSmart Tulsa event in conjunction with the Bob Dylan Center. She joins me by phone today on Studio Tulsa. Rachel Kushner, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
The Mars Room is this very interesting novel because in the course of it, without us even knowing, you take readers on this journey that helps us understand the injustice of the criminal justice system for people in poverty. And you do it through these really, really compelling characters, including the main narrator, Romy Hall, this young woman at the start of two consecutive life sentences in a California correctional facility. She's an engrossing and sympathetic character who helps interpret this world for us. How did that character come about?
Well, first I would maybe just say a little something about helping the reader understand injustice. I would never take issue with somebody describing their experience of reading the book in that manner, but wasn't myself trying to lead the reader to a particular position, you know, lead them to feel upset or disturbed or unsettled by a state of affairs that I'm describing in the book. Mm-hmm. It was more that I was thinking about contemporary times and California and the way that society is structured and the people I've known from my own childhood and adolescence and what a girl like Romy would feel like when she's been handed this very rigid condemnation that she's meant to pay back the state for the harm she's committed with the unit of a life, which is such a bizarre, abstract unit. I mean, when you consider that, you can absolutely fulfill your commitment to the state even if you only live another 44 days, or you can absolutely fulfill your commitment to the state if you live another 44 years. And either way, you've fulfilled your commitment to the state. So I was thinking about that collapsible term and just how it would feel for her, but not having already decided what the problem was or, God forbid, what the solution is, and wanting to, you know, enlighten readers to what I've seen or anything like that. I think the book is a much more of an open text of ruminating on difficult questions for me than it is a place to record something like outrage. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And there's a difference for me. But in terms of how the character was formed, she is a girl from my own neighborhood in San Francisco, and adolescence that she describes and remembers is one that I am intimately familiar with. And I didn't initially really want to do that in terms of use material that is in any way autobiographical. It's not really my nature as a fiction writer. I am more attracted to the form of the novel as a condition of possibility for taking leave from the self, immersing myself in a world, because that's in a way how I experience life. I'm someone who's faced outward and looking outward and a noticer and seer, rather than somebody who is constantly brooding over my life and the things I've experienced. And it's a perfectly legitimate way to approach the novel. And, you know, there are plenty of great writers who are turned inward, and I haven't really just traditionally been one of them. But for this book, I needed a narrator over whom I could have a real depth of understanding, a range of control. And in order to make her believably, plausibly, a woman who would end up going to prison and have a set of memories and a kind of material that she would draw from while she was there, because you are no longer really making memories inside prison. I mean, you have your daily life, but the things that defined who you were when you entered then are one closed set of memories that I feel people would be reviewing and reviewing. And I needed to give her a life I understood.
Yeah.
So she was formed by material that I'd lived to some degree, and that I had known people who'd lived. And so she was a kind of homage to a world that was real, that existed. And suddenly I was the scribe putting that history into a book.
The characters in the Mars Room are constantly reliving the life on the outside, on the inside. I think you're absolutely right. That's the memories they are holding are the ones that are long gone.
Yeah, there's also storytelling. I mean,
yes.
I've always, you know, I've heard, like, even just if somebody goes to the drunk tank for a night, if you go to jail, you're sitting there and people start talking up tall tales about, you know, what they were doing when they got caught up, what they do on the outside, this and that. So, like, all everybody has to go on about the other people are around them are how they act and who they say they are. So I think it's an occasion for dialogue and for people to try to use speech to impress or coerce or, you know, or seduce or threaten or impress others. So Romy's, you know, she's introspective because she's speaking in the first person, and she's using a sort of testimonial format, which is what the I is in a novel, if it's a spoken I. And she's not being completely candid with the reader. It's not like she's not an unreliable narrator, so-called, which is not really something I'm that interested in. But she's withholding, and she's speaking only what she wants to confess to. But the other characters where there's spoken dialogue in the book and they're talking about the past, like Conan, and it might be that they're just telling a tall tale, but they're entertaining people by telling it.
Right. And
something I've always been interested in that was even to some degree a theme in my prior novel is when people are telling you a lie, they're also telling you the truth. They're telling you something, whether what they say is factually true or not.
They're telling a idealized version of what they would consider the truth, or a truth they would like to see at some point, perhaps.
Yeah, or something else. They're telling you the kind of lie they tell,
yeah,
which is a true facet of their character.
Well, I know you spent some time visiting prisons to help understand this ecosystem. What was the most compelling things you learned, and how did that experience make you decide, okay, Romy needs to be somebody I know from my own experience to be able to tell her story truthfully?
Well, that's a very thoughtful question. I do visit people in prison regularly, and it wasn't something that I was just sort of undertaking in order to acquire an understanding that I would then utilize to write a novel.
Hmm.
It's more just something that I do in life, which is want to be in dialogue with people that have been invisibilized by the state of California. And that's partly based on having known people who went to prison when I was young, and partly based on just being a resident of Los Angeles, a big, complicated city and county that is, as the parlance goes, a big sender to state prisons. Most of the people in the prisons, which are situated, you know, deep in the geometry of industrial agriculture, are from the urban core of Southern California. And I'm involved with some human rights work in the prisons, in the women's prison mainly, Central California Women's Facility. And I email with people there regularly, and I have people who I'm trying to help with their court cases, either to get a resentencing hearing or to try to get a parole board hearing, and people who send me their writing, and I send them my stuff. And it's like friendship and dialogue and mentorship in both directions. And I don't think I would have been able to write the book, perhaps, if I didn't have those relationships, because they help me to understand certain mechanics of how life deep inside a prison works that I would not otherwise be aware of. But the relationships are not like what feeds into the novel. I didn't write about the lives of any of the women that I've gotten to know in prison. I consider that work separate from, but not entirely unrelated to, writing The Mars Room. And so maybe that feeds back to the second part of your question, which is that in talking to these women in prison, their lives have been so different than mine. No one I know serving a life sentence in prison has had a childhood that I would consider happy at all. And I did have a happy childhood. And the support that I get from my family is obvious to me as a demarcation of true difference. I would not go to prison. And yet, I was around people who did growing up. And I realized that there was just no way I was going to create a believable, plausible character unless I chose to write her as somebody who I would be intimately familiar with. Like, I couldn't have occupied the depth of understanding that I needed of a first-person character going into the situation if I made her like one of the women that I've met in the last several years. She had to be somebody who I really knew deeply.
Earlier in our conversation, you mentioned something about you wanted to shed a light on California society, and I think that's the way you termed it. And I assume you're talking about, to a degree, in every state. It's certainly very true in a place like Oklahoma, but certainly in California too, where this underclass is always at risk of being swept off the street for whatever transgressions that come out of their poverty, and they're just removed from society and out of sight, out of mind, for at least in Oklahoma. I'm assuming this is the sort of thing you're talking about in California too?
Yeah. You know, you're right. Oklahoma is a big incarcerator, and the rate of incarceration of women there, the way that it has, I mean, it's really skyrocketed, like, from 1980 to now, right?
Right.
I think it's one of the steepest.
Well, we're number one.
Number one, that's right. I should know this off the top of my head. But, you know, I learn all these statistics and in particular utilize them to write this, like, very long nonfiction piece that was in the New York Times Magazine. It came out on Easter Sunday. But for writing a novel, the statistics become less useful because I'm more looking at the granular symptoms of the problem, you know, rather than logging on to the Bureau of Justice statistics numbers. I don't even need to see the numbers. Structure is not conspiratorial. It may be deliberate, but it's not conspiratorial or necessarily inevitable. And, you know, so I'm hesitant to be a person who thinks, like, oh, there's a group of bad people in the state capitol who are like, you know, let's be mean to poor people. If that were the case, it would be easier to solve the issue. But, you know, California is a huge state. It's really complicated. And as I always say, we are fifth largest economy in the world. Our women's prison is the largest women's prison in the world. The state has a very high poverty rate, and you see that if you're somebody who's turned outward and looking at things. So I think that the prisons themselves are only the brick and mortar component of a larger organization to society. And it just so happens that if you're a middle-class person in California, you don't really have to think about the people at the bottom and the layer of society from which the prison populations are drawn. They're somehow by design, but again, not conspiratorially, rendered invisible to you. You meaning just that, you know, unnamed middle-class person. And so that's the structure there. Just the fact that the prison buses are shuttling up and down the main arteries that pass through the Central Valley in California. And I'm sure there are routes in Oklahoma that may be similar, where people are being taken from their home in either a rural community or, most commonly in California, a former industrialized core, you know, Los right. Angeles, the greater Southern California metropolitan region. And because of the act of some kind of harm that they've committed, the solution to the social problem is to lift them out of one place and posit them in another.
And The Mars Room starts with a scene like that. These women leaving Southern California, moving up the Central Valley to Stansville.
Yeah, that's sort of based on a famous prison bus ride that takes place every Thursday, and the bus has 60 seats. It's always full. So every Thursday night, 60 women go from the L.A. County Jail up to Chowchilla, where Central California Women's Facility is located. I haven't written on the bus, and I didn't talk to anybody really about the bus ride, but I knew enough when I wrote that scene to be able to try to deeply imagine what it would feel like and what you see from the bus.
My guest today is Rachel Kushner, the author of Telex from Cuba, The Flamethrowers, and her latest book is titled The Mars Room. It's published by Scribner. It's now out in a paperback, and she'll be speaking Thursday at 7 o'clock at a Congregation B'nai Amuna in a Book Smart Tulsa event in conjunction with the Bob Dylan Center as well, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Let's talk a little bit about this character of Romy Hall. As we meet her, the Mars Room alludes to this place where she's a young woman stripping. And in the course of it, we very slowly learn about this mysterious character, Kennedy, who is stalking her and is the reason for her incarceration. And it's very interesting the way you unfold that story. I don't want to give anything away, but this story just sort of comes out in bits and drabbles through the novel.
Yeah.
What was the reason for that?
Well, she's the one who's telling the story. And as I think I mentioned, when somebody speaks in the first person, it's a testimonial format. But she's the one who's in control of the testimony. So it's not like she's addressing a courtroom. There isn't a specific audience to her speech. Her speech, nonetheless, is geared towards some audience, and she's giving her side of the story. But there's always another side to the story, and I waited till the very end of the book to share the other side of the story, which is Kurt Kennedy's. And I didn't actually know until I was more than halfway through the book that I would give the reader a glimpse into his thought process. And the reason I decided to do it was I had been so focused on her experience of unwanted, constant, obsessive attention from this creepy dude, which was easy for me to understand and write about and describe, just, you know, naturally happen to know what that feels like. But suddenly it occurred to me that he wasn't paying this kind of unwanted attention to her in order to terrorize her or make her afraid or upset. That's not why anybody does that. They do it because they're totally desperate. This man is just, he thinks he needs to see her in order to survive. And that is infatuation taken to an extreme degree. But it is nonetheless along the spectrum of infatuation, which to me is defined by this. You are thinking about someone who may not be thinking about you. And anyone can understand that, because we've all experienced it. So when you take that to a deeper level, you end up with somebody like Kurt Kennedy, and suddenly I'm inside of him and actually have an enormous amount of sympathy for him.
Yeah. There's countless interesting scenes that I would love to talk to you about, but I want to talk about one. And Romy relates the story of her trial and her attorney, her public defender attorney, who she refers to as Johnson's attorney, because the previous case was a guy named Johnson, and it's the same attorney. But there's this interesting scene later in the novel where Johnson's lawyer comes to visit her.
Yeah.
And, you know, you said from the outset, I didn't have a position in this. This is not a polemical. It's about telling just a story of things I've experienced in working with people in prison and a story of one story of incarceration, if you will, and several stories, actually. But there's this interesting scene where he comes in and says, I just wanted to check on you. I, you know, feel sad about what happened. And, you know, Romy's saying, you know, I'm pretty sure I can make a case that you were an ineffective lawyer. And he comes back with saying, that's the worst thing you want to do. He says, nobody's going to listen to you, and you're not going to get anywhere with that. And really, that, to me, that was the moment where it's like, wow, you know, it doesn't matter what you do, being in a situation of poverty, the dice is always stacked against you. You're always going to roll snake eyes just about any time you try to roll the dice in a situation like this.
Well, yeah, I mean, I wasn't thinking of it so polemically. I really wasn't. But you know, bracketing the novel for a moment, it is, we have seen cases where people have committed a murder and there's evidence of it, and they can afford a powerful team of lawyers and either end up going free or getting a fairly light sentence, a relatively light sentence. And I have a friend from college who is a partner in Eric Holder's law firm. Eric Holder is a former attorney general under Obama. And he said to me, not that I ever would commit a crime, but he said, you know, if anything ever happened to you, you wouldn't go to prison because I would represent you. And so, you know, if you have a heavy-duty lawyer, you really are, in a certain sense, not entirely shielded, but substantially shielded from the justice system. And somebody at the bottom, I mean, you know, I think that a lot of public defenders are really incredible people and incredible lawyers who've dedicated their lives to public service, but their caseload is insane. And he's right when he tells her, she says, you know, if I could have afforded a private lawyer, this all would have gone differently. And he says, you were better off with me, and he's right. I have myself sat in courtrooms where, you know, a poor family who doesn't know any better has a child, an adult child, or adolescent child who's being tried as an adult, where they hire a private lawyer because they think that's the better way to go than using the state-appointed attorney. But the private lawyer is like a guy who handles drunk driving cases and then is representing somebody in a, you know, a capital case, a special circumstances murder, where there's a possibility that the defendant is going to get life without possibility of parole. And this private lawyer has no experience representing a client like that and no business doing so, whereas public defenders, you know, a lot of them are really experienced trial lawyers who've dealt with very heavy, difficult cases. So I think he's right in that, in a certain sense, it's idealized that he goes to visit her in the prison, because sure. I kind of based that lawyer a little bit on a public defender I met. I met him when he was retired, and he had been the court-appointed attorney for a young woman I know who was 15 years old when she was tried by the state of California as an adult and received the sentence that I gave to Romy. Two life sentences not to be served concurrently, plus a six-year special enhancement. And he never went to visit her. And he said that he thinks about her and meant to visit her and had intended to, but he didn't. And I asked a friend of mine who's a public defender, if you would think about a client of yours who ended up with a sentence like that. And she said, of course. Because I thought, you know, you have so many cases that maybe they neutralize one another, the horror of them. And she said, no, you would not forget that person. Hmm. So in the book, I have him pay the visit that he says he always meant to do.
I was really struck by a device you used to sort of help take the reader into the system. And there was three little short chapters, I would call them, that, and they're sort of list. One is the, what I'd say, a list of no's. It's the no's of the things you can't do in order to visit an inmate. And then there's another little list of the inmate's rules for visits. And then there was this really bizarre employment history in which you found all these people who work in the recycling business.
That's what people do at the very bottom of society, in any urban society, you know?
And my first
they
thought was,
bottles and cans.
Yeah, that was the whole thing. Is at first I was thinking, oh, they're working in a recycling facility. No, they're collecting bottles and cans. Yeah. No,
I mean, my mother and I collected bottles and cans on weekends when I was little. It's something that people without money do. But it's also, it's the informal economy, as it's called. And yet, you know, at this point, the more precarious informal economy globally is a structured element of how things are working. So people find ways to exist, and they're roaming the streets of Los Angeles all night long with shopping carts, collecting what they find on the streets. And, yeah, that's the part about work is sort of inspired by intake forms I've seen at the intake center for the men's jail in downtown Los Angeles, and then also from newspaper articles where the type of work done by a defendant is mentioned in passing, or the defendant states to the judge during arraignment what type of work they did on the outside, and I just compiled them into this, and I didn't realize until I'd already written it that somebody who turns in bottles and cans to a redemption center, as they are known, recycling centers are redemption centers, is a redeemer.
Yes, that's the last line of that little section. That's
yeah.
Right. My guest today is Rachel Kushner. Her latest book is out at Softcover. It's titled The Mars Room, and it is very darkly comic, but it's also a searing story, I think, in many ways of the criminal justice system, although she says she didn't write it that way. But nonetheless, it's a very honest portrayal of prison life for these characters, and there's some very interesting characters that you created in the course of it. I'm interested, you work with folks in prison or in jail as just a part of your life. Have any of those folks that you work with read The Mars Room?
Oh, yeah, they've all read it, of course. I gave it to them before it was published.
Yeah, what was the reaction for the most part?
Very positive. I didn't have any negative reactions from people inside prison. I mean, but I guess you're asking sort of what types of reactions. I mean, I think maybe one of my favorite reactions was a friend of mine, her name is Michelle Renee Scott, and actually she's going up before the parole board on July 10th because her sentence was commuted by the former governor of California, Jerry Brown, from life without parole to life. So we'll see what happens with her. She may be getting out, but Michelle read the book, and she wrote me a letter and said, it's beyond words for me to explain to you what it feels like to think that people in the outside world are going to read about the life that we live here. And my only worry is that when they read this, they'll think you're exaggerating because it's so unbelievable to people who haven't experienced it that this is what it's like.
Was that something you were quite careful not to exaggerate?
Well, it didn't really require that much care because there was no need to exaggerate.
Yeah, right.
It was more like a few of the things that I lifted from, you know, actual life in prisons that I know to be true were things that my editor flagged and said, Rachel, you know, I know you have a rich imagination, but this is a bit much.
Give us an example.
So I had to kind of curtail it a little bit.
Give me an example of something that she flagged.
Well, like there's a scene on Thanksgiving when they get served emu in the prison. And it's meant to be funny because people are so funny in prison. I mean, there's a level of comedy that is a cut above. And I think it's because people's personalities are all they have. That's the kind of flair they have as self-presentation. And so Conan is joking about it. And my editor flagged that and said, come on, you don't need to have them eating emu. But they do serve it, not just in California, but Arizona.
Well, there you go. There's an example. Sending supplies via the toilet system.
That's all real.
Yeah, no.
They send ice cream through the toilets, which was sort of surprising to me.
That is surprising. Well, it is a really interesting book, The Mars Room. Rachel, we look forward to your visit in Tulsa, and thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for reading my book and for your questions.
Novelist Rachel Kushner speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. Her latest novel, The Mars Room, was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize in 2018 and is now out in softcover. She'll be speaking about the book Thursday evening at 7 o'clock at B'nai Amunah Synagogue in a BookSmart Tulsa event in conjunction with the Bob Dylan Center. You can learn more at booksmarttulsa.com. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.